And Brother Joe has entitled his discourse, Seven Lessons from the Book of Esther. Seven Lessons from the Book of Esther. And while Brother Joe is making his introduction, at the same time we're going to have handouts being passed to all of you as we have two brethren here moving down the outside aisle. So when we get clear to the end, if we've missed anybody, just please hold your hand up and we'll make sure you get a handout. So at this time, we turn the time over to Brother Joe.
Thank you, Brother Randall. It's indeed a pleasure to be here with you, brethren. This is my first time at a Connellsville convention, and it's been a blessing so far, and I'm sure it will continue to be. I bring with me the warm Christian love and greetings of your brethren in Chicago, especially my wife, Sister Kathy, and our children, Adam and Hannah, who were originally planning to be with me here this weekend, but our plans changed a few weeks ago, and so I came alone. I also bring with me the love of my mother, Sister Florence Megaz, and my grandmother, Sister Stella Banis, who at age 99 still comes out to the meetings every Sunday. Also my parents-in-law, Brother Ted and Sister Marcy Martin, and also Brother Jeremy Zendler. The Book of Esther is something of an oddity because it is the answer to the Bible trivia question, what is the only book of the Bible in which the word God is not mentioned, not even once? We'll return to that thought toward the end of our discourse, but this afternoon we're going to consider seven lessons from the Book of Esther contained in the historical account of one of God's great deliverances, as we sang in our opening hymn, of his people when they were held captive in a foreign land. Let's begin by reading Esther chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, to establish the time and the place of this historical account. Esther 1, verses 1 through 4. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this is Ahasuerus which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia over 127 provinces, that in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the palace, in the third year of his reign he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces being before him. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days, even 180 days. The king Ahasuerus, here mentioned, is known in secular history as the Persian monarch Xerxes. And if you've all received your handouts by now, if you haven't, please raise your hand. If you have, I'd like you to take a look at the lower half of that handout. I see a few hands in front here, if there are any more copies. If you look at the lower half of the front page of your handout, you'll see the title, Historical Background of the Book of Esther. And you'll see above the map a timeline there of the history of the kings of Israel, which ended with Zedekiah, who was overthrown in 606 B.C. by Nebuchadnezzar, following which was the 70 years of Babylonian dominion ending in 536. And then followed the empire of Medo-Persia, the Medes and the Persians, Darius the Mede, and Cyrus the Persian, who were joint co-regents at the beginning of that empire. And it's in the time of Darius and Cyrus that Daniel's story was told. Actually, Daniel's story goes back to Babylon, when he was taken captive as a young man, lived through the 70 years, and then the story of Daniel in the lion's den takes place when he was much older, under the reign of Cyrus and Darius. So if you want to put the story of Esther in its historical, chronological context, think of the story of Daniel in the lion's den, and then move forward about 50 years. There were several Persian kings, Cambyses, Darius the Persian, a different Darius than Darius the Mede, followed by Xerxes, about 50 years after the Medo-Persian Empire was founded. And it's this Xerxes in secular history who is the Ahasuerus of the Book of Esther in the Bible. If you want to place the story of Esther in a geographical context, you can look at the map at the very bottom of your handout, and I apologize for the poor quality of it, but I think you can sort of tell from the darkened black landmass that the empire of the Medes and the Persians extended from the left, the west, you can see the Mediterranean Sea, below that Egypt and above that parts of Greece, which were the western extremities of the Medo-Persian Empire. And then on the far right of your map would be India, the eastern extremity of the Persian Empire. And in the middle, down at the bottom, you can probably see a white mass, the Persian Gulf, their body of water. Above that, in the black landmass, is the city of Susa, which may be visible on some of your maps if you look closely. That city, Susa, is the capital of the Persian Empire, and it is the Shushan, the city of Shushan that we read in verse 2 of Esther chapter 1. As we also read in verses 3 and 4 of Esther chapter 1, the king Ahasuerus, or again Xerxes in secular history, threw a great feast lasting 6 months, 180 days, for all of the nobles and princes throughout the empire. And this was no doubt a war conference, when Ahasuerus was soliciting the support of the princes of the provinces to send in their men to form the army and the navy for a great battle that he was about to wage. And the grand culmination of this six-month convention of all the princes and nobles in Shushan, the capital city, the culmination of that was a party to end all parties, a seven-day great feast described in verses 5 through 9 of Esther chapter 1. We won't take the time to read those, but you'll see in those verses, 5 through 9 of chapter 1, all the details of the great feasts and the party decorations that Ahasuerus prepared, again, to solicit the help and support for his battle plans from the princes and nobles of the kingdom. But that historical and chronological introduction brings us to the main part of our discourse. On the top of your handout, you'll see listed seven lessons from the book of Esther. The first five are practical lessons. The sixth is a cultural lesson, and the seventh is a spiritual lesson. Although the first five are really spiritual lessons applied perhaps in a more practical way. And there are, of course, many additional lessons, many more lessons beyond these seven in the story of Esther, but the seven listed on your handout are the ones we'll consider today. Lesson one is taken from chapter 1, and lesson number 1 is, sometimes dignity with grace in the presence of the undignified is the best rebuke. In Esther chapter 1, verses 10 through 22, is the account of how on the last day of this great feast, this seven-day feast, King Ahasuerus called for Queen Vashti to come in to his banquet so that he could show her off in her beauty to the other men. And she refused. Let's read a part of that account. We'll start on verse 10, and I'll be skipping through some of it. We'll read parts of verses 10 through 22. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded the seven chamberlains that served in the presence of Ahasuerus, the king, to bring Vashti, the queen, before the king, with the crown royal, to show the people and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to look on. But the queen Vashti refused to come at the king's commandment by his chamberlains. Therefore was the king very wroth, and his anger burned in him. Skip down to verse 15, where the king asks his wise men, what shall we do unto Queen Vashti according to law, because she hath not performed the commandment of the king Ahasuerus by the chamberlains? Skipping down to verse 17, one of his counselors answers, for this deed of the queen shall come abroad unto all women, so that they shall despise their husbands in their eyes, when it shall be reported, the king Ahasuerus commanded Vashti the queen to be brought in before him, but she came not. Likewise shall the ladies of Persia and Media say this day unto all the king's princes which have heard of the deed of the queen. Thus there shall arise too much contempt and wrath. So the king's nobles were afraid that if the queen can get away with this from the king, what's going to happen to the rest of us men and our wives? And so his counselors said to the king that he should make a decree that Vashti would no longer be queen and that someone should be found to take her place. On reprint page 4900, Pastor Russell offers this on Vashti's course of action. This is again his reprint, page 4900. Many will say that she did just right in asserting her womanhood, in standing up for her rights. We will not dispute that all women have rights and that Queen Vashti had hers and that she exercised them. We merely offer the suggestion that in a question of rights along lines of force and compulsion, Queen Vashti won a victory which cost her dearly. However much she might have felt that the king's requirement of her presence would expose her to jest or rudeness, she should have relied upon her charm and tact and purity and upon her husband's love and care. While it was not hers to intrude into the banquet, once invited, her presence should have been a hallowed one, a sweet perfume, a rebuke to any immodesty. End of quote. The application of this first lesson here is not for sisters only, or for women in general in the world in the sexual harassment that still occasionally occurs today. Men also find themselves in similar situations, as an example at their work, subjected to indignity or embarrassment, sometimes for sport, and sometimes maliciously, with intent to injure and humiliate. Deciding how to react is difficult and painful. But sometimes dignity with grace, not an affected holier-than-thou attitude, but dignity with grace in the presence of the undignified is the best rebuke. The second of our seven lessons from the Book of Esther is the greatest beauty is in a natural, unadorned simplicity. Let's read parts of chapter 2, Esther chapter 2, verses 1 through 7, and then verses 12 through 17. Esther 2, 1 through 7. After these things, that is, after the decree went out that Vashti would no longer be queen, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, let there be fair young virgins sought for the king. And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather together all the fair young virgins unto Shushan the palace, to the house of the women, unto the custody of Hegi, the king's chamberlain, keeper of the women, and let their things for purification be given them. And let the maiden which pleaseth the king be queen instead of Vashti. And the thing pleased the king, and he did so. Now in Shushan the palace there was a certain Jew, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity, which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And he, that is Mordecai, brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, her Hebrew name was Hadassah, her Persian name was Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother, and the maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took for his own daughter. As the account tells us, many fair young maidens were brought to the palace to be the king's wives and were put in charge of Hegi for 1 year to be purified and beautified. 6 months beauty treatment with oil of myrrh, followed by 6 months more with perfumes and other ointments. Then when it was each woman's turn to go into the king to consummate the marriage, she was given the opportunity to browse through the king's best jewels and clothes and adornments and take whatever she wanted to wear for that night and keep them. Let's read verses 12 through 17. Now when every maid's turn was come to go into King Ahasuerus, after that she had been 12 months according to the manner of the woman, so were the days of their purifications accomplished, to wit, 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with sweet odors, and with other things for the purifying of the women. Then thus came every maiden unto the king. Whatsoever she desired was given her to go with her out of the house of the women unto the king's house. In the evening she went, and on the morrow she returned into the second house of the women, to the custody of Sheashgaz, the king's chamberlain, which kept the concubines. She came in unto the king no more, except the king delighted in her, and that she were called by name. Now when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her for his daughter, was come to go in unto the king, she required nothing but what Hegi the king's chamberlain, the keeper of the women appointed. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all them that looked upon her. So Esther was taken unto King Ahasuerus into his house royal in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. And the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Now picture this night for all of these young women as they are about to enter the king's house after a year to consummate their marriage to him. Tradition says these women were young, perhaps only 15 years of age, to assure their virginity. They were trained for a year in the arts of beauty, and then, on the exciting night when they went into the king, they could take whatever they wanted from the king's treasure: gold bracelets, rings, necklaces, and so on. I would bet every one of these teenage girls' eyes popped out when the king's treasure chests were opened to them and they could take whatever they want. They probably grabbed as much as they could carry, as much as they could wear of rings and bracelets and necklaces. They probably had difficulty walking with the weight of so much gold upon them, and the king could probably hardly see what they looked like behind all that jewelry. But not so with Esther. Esther was mature beyond her years, and in God's providence had found favor in the sight of Hege, who had counseled her to simple adornments so as not to hide her own natural beauty. The primary application of this lesson I want to make is to the truth itself. The beauty of the truth is in its simplicity and in its harmony. Its natural loveliness, natural here referring to the nature of its author, God, and his divine plan, and the truth as revealed to us through his faithful and wise servant. The beauty of that truth does not need man-made adornments or reasonings or explanations. There is also a secondary application of this lesson, that the most beauty is in a simple and natural beauty, and that is to the way we conduct our lives and our affairs and our relationships with others. An excess of the busyness and the trappings of modern living can sometimes obscure the natural beauty of a simple, sanctified life. The greatest beauty in the truth and in our own lives is sometimes in a natural, unadorned simplicity. Our third lesson from the book of Esther is: complete obedience to God saves later regret. Let's read Esther 3, verses 1 through 7. Esther 3, verses 1 through 7. After these things, and this is after Esther had become queen, did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him, and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. Then the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said unto Mordecai, Why transgressest thou the king's commandment? Now it came to pass, when they spake daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman. They kept telling Mordecai, day after day, bow down to Haman. Mordecai said, No, I will not. So they told Haman about Mordecai, to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand. In other words, all right, Haman, what are you going to do about this? For he had told them that he, that is Mordecai, was a Jew. Verse 5, And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had showed him the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. So when they said to Haman, What are you going to do about this? He thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, meaning, I'm not just going to kill him. I'm going to wipe out his whole race. That was the evil in Haman's heart. The account goes on to tell how Haman persuaded Ahasuerus to decree that all the Jews should be killed and that a spoil should be taken from them on the 13th day of Adar. The key scripture in our third lesson here, complete obedience to God saves later regret, is in verse 1, but I bet you'd have real trouble finding it. Because the obedience I'm referring to is not in the book of Esther. Notice Esther 3:1 tells us that Haman was an Agagite, that is, a descendant of Agag, who was an Amalekite. Now let's turn back to 1 Samuel chapter 15 to hear the story of Agag, the Amalekite. We'll read 1 Samuel chapter 15, verses 2, 3, and 9. 1 Samuel 15, verses 2, 3, and 9. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I remember that which Amalek did to Israel, how he laid wait for him in the way when he came up from Egypt. That is in the Exodus, when the Amalekites lay in wait and ambushed the Israelites as they passed through their land. Verse 3, now go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass. Verse 9, but Saul and the people spared Agag, and the best of the sheep, and of the oxen, and of the fatlings, and the lambs, and all that was good, and would not utterly destroy them. But everything that was vile and refuse, of no use, that they destroyed utterly. Later on in the account, it speaks of how indeed Agag was captured and slain, but apparently at least some of his children, probably sons, survived when they should have been slain. Had Saul slain Agag, the king of the Amalekites, and all of his house, his children, his sons, as God had directed him to do, Agag would never have had a descendant Haman, who was brought up with a heritage of 600 years of hatred for the Jews, who had slain most but not all of his entire Amalekite race in the time of King Saul. There's an interesting family connection, bloodline connection between Esther and Saul and Agag, and it's in Esther's older cousin Mordecai. Let's reread Esther chapter 2, verse 5. Esther 2, 5. Now in Shushan the palace there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Now, the words son of here do not literally mean one generation, like grandfather, son, grandson, and so on. The words son of imply several generations. It could probably be more translated descendant of rather than son of. So the thought is that Mordecai was a descendant of Jair, several generations, who was the descendant of Shimei, several generations, who was the descendant of Kish. Do you know who Saul's father was, King Saul? It was Kish. Therefore, Mordecai was Saul's great-great-great-great-great-great-nephew. Saul's father, Kish, was Mordecai's great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, about 20 generations worth of greats. And so they were related, Saul and Mordecai and Esther. And it was Saul's incomplete obedience to God in not killing Agag and his sons that meant his relatives, Mordecai and Esther, had to contend with a threat to the entire Jewish race in much more difficult times, indeed, than Saul's time when he was told to slay the Amalekites. The third lesson in the story of Esther is really from the story of Saul and the Amalekites, but the lesson is a good one. Here it is. Sometimes we destroy the outward foolish things associated with a sin, but we save alive the king's sin in our hearts, thinking we have done God's will. Sometimes we hold back a portion of that which we have consecrated to sacrifice, thinking that it won't be noticed or that it doesn't matter. That brings us to the fourth lesson from the story of Esther, and it's the most central one in the book, because in this one, the main character is Esther herself. Our fourth lesson is, when confronted with a difficult situation, act in faith after prayer and fasting. In the fourth and fifth chapters of Esther, Mordecai tells Esther of the king's decree to slay all the Jews that Haman had prompted the king to write. And Mordecai asks Esther to intercede with the king on behalf of the Jews. At first, Esther is hesitant. Let's read Esther chapter 4, verses 10 and 11. Esther 4, verses 10 and 11. And Esther spake unto Hatak, this was Mordecai's messenger who brought to Esther Mordecai's plea to intercede with King Ahasuerus on behalf of the Jews. Esther spake unto Hatak and gave him commandment unto Mordecai. This is her answer. Tell my uncle this. All the king's servants and all the people of the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king into the inner court who is not called, there is one law of his to put him to death, except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter, that he may live. But I have not been called to come in unto the king these 30 days. So because Esther had not been called, she was afraid simply to walk into the king's presence and give to him her plea, as Mordecai was asking her to do. Verses 12 through 14 of Esther chapter 4 are Mordecai's reply to Esther's hesitancy. And they told to Mordecai Esther's words. Then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place, but thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Upon hearing Mordecai's reply, Esther's heart is moved, and so she answers in verses 15 through 17. Then Esther bade them return Mordecai this answer. Go. Gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan, and fast ye for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days, night or day. I also and my maidens will fast likewise, and so will I go in unto the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther had commanded him. Again, our fourth lesson is, when confronted with a difficult situation, act in faith after prayer and fasting. Along these lines, Pastor Russell had these gem thoughts in reprint 3657. This is from reprint 3657. There is a beautiful lesson of faith here that should appeal to all of the spiritual Israelites. Whatever we have, whatever positions we occupy of influence or power or wealth or confidence in the esteem of others, is so much of a stewardship granted to us by the Lord, and respecting which we should expect to give an account. And if the account would be rendered with joy, we must be faithful even to the risking of our lives in the interests of the Lord's people, the Lord's cause. Let us lay this feature of Esther's experience to heart, that we may draw valuable lessons therefrom, helpful to us in the spiritual way. The suggestion that she had not come to a place of honor and privilege by accident, but that the Lord had overruled in the matter, is one that should appeal to all Israelites indeed. Whatever we have is of the Lord's providence. Let us use it faithfully and as wisely as possible for him and his. Thus our own blessings and joys will be increased, as well as our favor with the Lord. End of quote. Esther was indeed in a difficult situation. Her hesitancy to approach Ahasuerus was for two good reasons. The first one mentioned in chapter 4, verse 11, was that Ahasuerus had not summoned Esther for a month, and so perhaps he was feeling cool toward her and not likely to listen to her plea. The second reason that Esther was hesitant, which is not explained in the biblical account, was because Persian kings were notoriously quick to wrath and brutal, not only to their enemies, but even to their friends who displeased them. Along this line, Pastor Russell recounts this history in reprint page 3657. It is recorded of this very king, Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, that when en route for a war, he rested at Olenae of Phrygia, where he was the guest of Pythias, who entertained him magnificently. But when the king's host begged as a favor that of his five sons in the king's army, the eldest might be left with him in his old age, the brutal Xerxes, in a rage, caused that son to be slain in the presence of his father, the body divided into two parts, the one part placed on one side of the road and the other on the other side, and the whole army marched between them. End of quote. To act in faith, as our lesson says, means, as it says, to act, to take action, do something, and not merely expect the Lord to resolve the difficult situation we find ourselves in entirely on his own. Along this line is our final quote, again from reprint page 3657. The queen's plans were evidently all well thought out, although at this time she was only about 15 years of age. Doubtless the Lord granted the wisdom necessary for the occasion. She did not communicate her request, but rather led on the king's expectancy by inviting him first to come to a banquet, which she had arranged in his honor, and to which also his most trusted officer, Haman, was invited. The appointment was kept, and at that banquet the queen again parried the inquiry as to her real desire by asking that the same two should honor her by attending a banquet on the day following also, and this was agreed to. Here's the lesson. Some of the Lord's dear people of the spiritual Israel are a little inclined to go to extremes, and, trusting in the Lord, do nothing to forward the cause they wish to serve. We believe that Esther's course is a good example of propriety. We should both watch and pray, labor and wait, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. We should do all in our power while trusting to the Lord for the results, assured that he is able to make up all of our deficiencies, but at the same time, leaving as little deficiency as possible. End of quote. Act in faith with prayer and fasting. The fasting on Queen Esther's experience may have been total abstinence from food and drink, as the account suggests, or it may also have been merely a simple diet to minimize the pleasurable distractions from taking her mind's concentration away from the situation at hand and the planning she must do. For us today, the lesson is similar, but the pleasurable distractions of the 1990s are not simply limited to food and drink. Fasting for us, in order to focus our mind's energies on a spiritual struggle or other difficult situation we find ourselves in, means to avoid any and all time wasters and attention stealers. The spirit of the world is to deny and avoid difficult situations, to put off making the tough, sometimes no-win decisions, to avoid personal responsibility. The Lord is testing us and observing our willingness to be single-minded and aggressive in making our calling and election sure. In that last reprint quotation that I read, Pastor Russell suggested that Esther was only about 15 years of age when these events took place. Being a young teenager, she might well have been tempted to avoid the difficult situation confronting her, to run and hide, to do nothing. But Mordecai warned her in chapter 4, verses 13 and 14, as we read, "Think not that thou shalt escape death because you live in the king's house, in the king's palace. You and your father's house will be destroyed." Esther's strength of will and resolve is expressed in her words, "And if I perish, I perish," are an example to each one of us who have covenanted to be sacrificed unto death. Our fifth lesson from the book of Esther is, humility is the second best policy. And we're all familiar with the old expression, honesty is the best policy, and that's a true saying. In Haman's case, where this fifth lesson is illustrated, a little more honesty and a lot more humility would have gone a long way toward preserving his career and his life. In Esther's chapter 6 and 7, Ahasuerus is reminded of Mordecai's loyalty to him, Ahasuerus, in saving him from a plot to kill him, and that nothing was done to reward Mordecai for this loyalty and his warning to the king against this plot on his life. And so the king asks Haman, who had come to Ahasuerus to ask permission to hang Mordecai, the king asks Haman, before he makes his request, what should the king do to honor someone who has served him faithfully and the king desires to honor? Let's read that account. This is in Esther chapter 6. We'll read verses 6 through 10. Esther 6, verses 6 through 10. "So Haman came in, and the king said unto him, What shall be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor? Now Haman thought in his heart, To whom would the king delight to do honor more than to myself? And Haman answered the king, For the man whom the king delighteth to honor, let the royal apparel be brought, which the king useth to wear, and the horse that the king rideth upon, and the crown royal which is set upon his head. And let his apparel and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man withal whom the king delighteth to honor. And bring him on horseback through the street of the city, and proclaim before him, Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delighteth to honor." Can't you just imagine Haman making this speech? He can already see himself on this horse, riding through the city. Verse 10. "Then the king said to Haman, Make haste and take the apparel and the horse, as thou hast said, and do even so to Mordecai the Jew that sitteth at the king's gate. Let nothing fail of all that thou hast spoken." You can just picture Haman's face. So it was done as the king answered. But Haman still had his plot in mind. And so he had an enormous gallows, 50 cubits high, prepared for Mordecai to be hanged upon. Now, Esther's request of the king for these two banquets was granted. And in chapter 7, we pick up the account of Haman and the king at the second of Esther's banquets that she requested with the king. Let's read verses 1 through 10. It's the entire chapter, chapter 7. For our story. Esther 7, 1 through 10. "So the king and Haman came to the banquet with Esther the queen. And the king said again unto Esther on the second day at the banquet of wine, What is thy petition, Queen Esther? And it shall be granted to thee. And what is thy request? And it shall be performed even to the half of the kingdom. Then Esther the queen answered and said, If I have found favor in thy sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. But if we had been sold for bondmen and bondwomen, I had held my tongue." In other words, if we had merely been told we were going to be slaves for life, I would not make this request, although the enemy could not countervail the king's damage. Then the king Ahasuerus answered and said unto Esther the queen, Who is he and where is he that durst presume in his heart to do so, that is to kill you, my lovely wife, and all your people? Verse 6, And Esther said, The adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. Then Haman was afraid before the king and the queen. And the king, arising from the banquet of wine in his wrath, went into the palace garden, and Haman stood up to make request for his life to Esther the queen, for he saw that there was evil determined against him by the king. Then the king returned out of the palace garden into the place of the banquet of wine, and Haman was fallen upon the bed where Esther was. He was pleading for his life. He probably first kneeled at her feet, and then when she wouldn't hear him, he probably put his hands upon her to urgently make his request. Then said the king, Will he force the queen also before me in the house? As the word went out of the king's mouth, they, that is, the palace guards, covered Haman's face, and they dragged him out. And Harbonah, one of the chamberlains, said before the king, Behold also the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman had made for Mordecai, who had spoken good for the king, standeth in the house of Haman. Then the king said, Hang him, that is Haman, thereon. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then was the king's wrath pacified. Haman's pride, which could not accept Mordecai's refusal to pay him homage, that we read very earlier, did him in. Haman's pride, which desired the king's favor in an ostentatious, showy way in his robes on his horse, above all the other princes and nobles, did him in. And I suppose it's poetic justice that at the very end of his life, Haman was reduced to begging for his life at the feet of a 15-year-old Jewish girl, and that his fate was sealed when the king mistook the meaning of his prostration upon the queen upon her bed and ordered Haman hanged on the gallows that he had built for Mordecai. I told you before, Persian kings were notoriously quick to wrath and brutal even to their friends who had displeased them. Again, the lesson is to be humble, not like Haman. And our Lord placed great importance on this quality of humility in his followers, as in Matthew 18, 1 through 4, where he answered the disciples who asked him, Who would be the greatest in the kingdom? By setting a little child before them and saying, Whoever shall humble himself as this child, the same shall be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And also in John 13, verses 4 through 17, where Jesus washed the disciples' feet as an example of service in humility. Let's move on now to our sixth lesson from the book of Esther, which has to do with the feast of Purim, which is part of the Jewish cultural heritage. In chapter 8 is the account of how, while Ahasuerus could not rescind or nullify his original edict, the laws of the Medes and Persians could not be changed, he did command that the Jews could defend themselves against any attack and take a spoil of all who dared attack them under the provisions of his first edict, which Haman had persuaded the king to write. And on that day, when the appointed day had come, the Jews did indeed slay many of their enemies, but they did not spoil the goods. They had learned their lesson from Saul's day and the Amalekites, when they were told, kill them all, take no spoil. They didn't do it then, but they learned this time and took no spoil. In chapter 9, and we don't have time to read these accounts now, they're very interesting. Read the whole book yourself from chapter 1, verse 1 to the end. It's quite a dramatic story. In chapter 9 is the beginning of the Feast of Purim, which was established to commemorate God's mighty deliverance of the Jews against this potentially race-eliminating attack. I wanted to read verses 20 through 26, but we don't have time. The Feast of Purim is still celebrated by Jews today, in the spring of the year, often in our month of March. and it's a happy festive occasion on which gifts are exchanged. The story of Esther is told in the homes and read in the synagogues as a commemoration, and it's even acted out by children dressed in costumes representing the main characters. And in the telling or the reading of the story, whenever the name of Haman is about to be mentioned, the people call out and they make noise so that Haman's name is not even heard in the congregation. The word Purim, for which this feast is named in the story of Esther, is the plural of Pur. In Hebrew, the letters I-M, actually those are the English translations of the Hebrew letters I-M, at the end of a word is like our S. It makes a singular into a plural. So Purim is the plural of Pur. Purim were the lots cast before Haman to pick the day for this attack upon the Jews. Let's read Esther 3:7. It's back early in our account. We skipped over it earlier. Esther 3:7. And this is when Haman had decided in his heart to slay all the Jews because one of them, Mordecai, would not bow before him. In Esther 3:7, in the first month, that is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is the lot, before Haman from day to day and from month to month to the 12th month, that is the month Adar. What exactly was done here and how it was done is not clear, but apparently some sort of dice were rolled or stones thrown or sticks dropped, which gave an indication of good fortune or bad. There was some lucky combination of these dice or stones or sticks that was looked for. And these dice or stones or sticks were thrown repeatedly, day to day, to select the most fortunate month and then the day of the month for carrying out Haman's plot to destroy the Jews. And the supposedly lucky day for the Persians that emerged from this repeated casting of the lots, or Purim, was the 13th day of the 12th month Adar. So the word went out to all the people of Persia to strike the Jews on that day. But the 13th of Adar turned out to be anything but lucky for Haman's 10 sons who were hanged on that day, and for the Persians who dared to rise up against the Jews. Our time is fleeting, so I'm going to move directly to our seventh and last lesson from the book of Esther. It's a spiritual lesson, although indeed the first five were likewise, but this one is perhaps a little less tangible, but nonetheless meaningful. And our seventh lesson is, God is sometimes hidden from our view, but the evidences of his providence are unmistakable. At the beginning of this discourse, I mentioned that the name of God does not appear anywhere in the book of Esther, not even once. Not even is the name God not recorded, but no reference to the great creator of the universe or the word Jehovah. And from a historical perspective, it's easy to understand why this is so. The book of Esther, as we have it in our Bible, was probably written by Mordecai. And again, remember, as we said, Mordecai was a servant in the house of the Persian king Ahasuerus, who ruled the Medo-Persian Empire. This letter is the account of the events that happened under the auspices of the king. This letter was written by scribes in the house of the king and distributed by messengers, the Persian post office, also in employ of the king, Ahasuerus. This entire letter was written, copied, and distributed as a government project by the Persians. So, of course, you would expect that in such an undertaking, not only would there be no mention of a god, Jehovah, that the Persians did not worship, but there would also be the obligatory statements of praise and magnificence about the king who ran the government, who was copying and distributing these letters. And indeed, there were such examples. We read one before in the very first verse of this book. Let's go back to Esther chapter 1, verse 1 and also verse 20. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this is Ahasuerus, which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia over 127 provinces. Mordecai was very wise. He knew that in order to get this letter approved by the king and sent out to all the Jews in the kingdom, he had to inflate Ahasuerus' ego. And so he did. And also in verse 20 of chapter 1. And when the king's decree which he shall make shall be published throughout all his empire, for it is great, all the wives shall give to their husbands honor both to great and small. So again, imagine yourself in Mordecai's shoes. You work for Ahasuerus. You're writing this history of God's mighty deliverance. But you know that if you say, Jehovah did this all, what are your chances of getting that letter copied and distributed to your fellow countrymen in the far reaches of the empire? None. So that's why the name Jehovah does not appear at all in the book of Esther. Or does it? Maybe it is there. Not spelled out letter for letter, Jehovah, as you would expect to read it. Not plainly written, but hidden in the form of an acrostic, so that only those who know God's name would see it and recognize it. Let me illustrate what I mean by Jehovah's name hidden in an acrostic. And if you look at the back side of your handout, you'll see an illustration that I've tried to fabricate in the English language. Of course, in the Hebrew, the tetragrammaton, the four Hebrew letters that are the consonants of the word Yahweh, YHWH or JHWH, are translated by those letters into English. I haven't written the Hebrew letters here, but I've written their English equivalents, JHWH. If I were to write you a letter, long letter, many sentences, many paragraphs, but in that letter you would see certain constructions like, just how was he? And here were her jade bracelets. And I had to fabricate a name here that ends on the letter J because I couldn't think of a real word. Raj Smith saw fish, and Seth flew with Raj. And especially if you notice that the first letter of those four words was larger than the others, you would pick out that pattern, J-H-W-H, and you'd say, aha, Brother Joe in his letter has sort of encrypted the name of God. There is a suggestion in an appendix at the rear of the Companion Bible that four acrostics just like this appear in the original Hebrew language version of the book of Esther. And I've cited the verses, Esther 5:4, 1:27:7, and 5:13, where they appear. I'm going to read a portion of the appendix. Again, this is appendix 60 in the back of the Companion Bible. God's working was secret and hidden. Hence the name of Jehovah is hidden secretly four times in this book. Three ancient manuscripts are known in which the acrostic letters in all cases are written larger than the others so that they stand out boldly and prominently. The following four phenomena are noticed in examining the four acrostics which form the name Jehovah. In each case, the four words forming the acrostic are consecutive. In each case, except the first, they form a sentence complete in itself. The first two acrostics are a pair, having the name formed by the initial letters of the four words. The last two are a pair, having the name formed by the final letters of the four words. The first and third acrostics are a pair, having the name spelled backward. The second and fourth are a pair, having the name spelled forward. The first and third, in which the name is formed backwards, are a pair being spoken by Gentiles. The second and fourth, in which the name is spelled forward, are a pair being spoken by Israelites. It is remarkable also that in the two cases where the name is formed by the initial letters, the first letters, the facts recorded are initial also and are spoken of an event in which Jehovah's overruling was initiated, while in the two cases where the name is formed by the final letters, the events are final also and lead rapidly up to the end toward which Jehovah was working. That again is a quote from Appendix 60 in the back of the Companion Bible. There is perhaps one other place in the book of Esther where the writer implied and hinted at Jehovah but did not mention his name. We read it already. Let's read it again. Esther 4, verse 14. This is Mordecai speaking to Esther to impress upon her the urgency of the situation and the need for her to act before the king on behalf of Israel. Esther 4, 14. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? The obvious answer to Mordecai's question, who knoweth, was God knows. God directs. God overrules the affairs of his people and his children and puts them in position to do his will with a sometimes invisible but nonetheless unmistakable hand. In our own lives, in matters great and in matters small, God is sometimes hidden from our view, but the evidences of his providence are unmistakable. God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. And may God add his blessing.
Thank you, Brother Joe, for bringing us another blessing and bringing to us the seven lessons from the book of Esther. We appreciate your service very, very much. And we'll look forward to also listening to it again and again by the use of the cassette tapes. We would like to close with singing hymn 63. We'd like to sing all the verses there. And we'd ask Brother Joe to close this portion in prayer. And if you just remain seated for a short time, we do have a couple of announcements. Hymn 63.
Heavenly Father, we bow before thee once again, thankful indeed for thy overruling providences in our lives and in the examples we have in thy holy word. We pray before thee, Father, that thou would continue to guide us, watch over us, Help us to combat the forces of evil that are arrayed against us. Shelter us and protect us from them. We pray not only for ourselves here, Father, but for all thy children the world over, and we pray for thy kingdom to come. We pray thy overruling on anything said, not in accordance with thy will this past hour, that I would overrule everything for our spiritual good. And we ask all these things and pray thy continuance with us in the further sessions of this convention. In Jesus' name, amen.
Brethren, if any of you are not going to break bread with us for dinner, please let me know. And if you can't find me, just let one of the Collinsville brethren know. We do encourage you to sign the cards for the sick and the isolated over here to my left, to your right on the table. And each of us have the privilege to initiate a card or a note to somebody. But if you do this, just please supply the address. It makes it a little bit easier for us to get it to that particular person if you put the address when you initiate the letter. Also, the convention tapes are available at the back of the room by the podium. There's a little table set up, and it's a self-serve arrangement there. And I do believe that the convention tapes are available for the study last evening and the two talks for this morning. So we're pretty well up to Brother Joe's talk here. Brother Joe's not available yet. So anyway, just help yourself back there, and there's a money box, and you can just serve yourself with the tapes as you would desire. Also, too, we do encourage you to sign the guest book in the back. You know, we're living in an age where if you go to a mall or something and you sign up for something, somebody's probably going to call you to sell you some of the world's goods. Well, the Collinsville brethren, I think I can say this with accuracy, promise not to sell you or call you to sell you any of the world's goods. But the brethren here do promise to love you, okay? And it's really an encouragement for all of us here at in the Collinsville Ecclesia to pick up that guest book and just read over the names of the dear folks and brethren. And young brethren, we encourage the young brethren to sign it too. So you're bringing a blessing to us when you sign the guest book. And we promise not to call you or contact you to sell you any kind of a service.